On RN, I'm Cassie McCullough, and this is Life Matters. We've been with you today as Natasha Mitchell takes some leave. Now, where were you 15 years ago? Can you remember where you might have been on a certain afternoon? Right now, the question of memory and its veracity is at the heart of Serial, the most popular podcast of all time. It's being made by WBEZ Public Radio in Chicago, and you might have heard the first episode of it right here on RN. Now, Serial investigates the 1999 murder of a teenaged girl named Hay Min Lee after her 17-year-old boyfriend Adnan Syed was arrested for the crime. He spent a lot of time trying to convince the jury that he had no idea about what had happened to her. But within a year, he was convicted and sentenced to spend the rest of his life in prison. Now, some believe he's telling the truth, and many others do. But the whole case revolves around the witnesses and who remembers what about the afternoon Hay Min Lee went missing. Here's Serial producer Sarah Koenig at the beginning of episode one.
It's really hard to account for your time, in a detailed way, I mean. How'd you get to work last Wednesday, for instance? Drive? Walk? Bike? Was it raining? Are you sure? Who did you talk to? The entire day, name every person you talked to. It's hard. Now imagine you have to account for a day that happened 6 weeks back, because that's a situation in the story I'm working on, in which a bunch of teenagers had to recall a day 6 weeks earlier. And it was 1999, so they had to do it without the benefit of texts or Facebook or Instagram. Just for a lark, I asked some teenagers to try it.
Do you remember what you did on that Friday?
No, not
at all. I can't remember anything that far back. I'm pretty sure I was in school, I think. No?
I've got no idea what I was doing. I'm pretty sure I was at work, though. That's Serial producer Sarah Koenig. And I'm a fan of this podcast. And another one is with us now. Her name is Amanda Barnier. She's a professor of cognitive science at Macquarie University, and she's obsessed with memory and how it works. Hello and welcome to Life Matters.
Morning, Cassie.
This Serial thing is, you can't sort of overstate how popular it's been, but at the centre of what's a true crime story, it is a meditation on memory and how it works.
I think it absolutely is a meditation on memory, because at its heart, you've got two people saying quite different things. Adnan Syed said, "I didn't do it. I didn't kill her. I don't know who did." Jay, the other young man who testified against him, said, "Adnan did it and I helped him bury the body." So how on earth do we reconcile those entirely different accounts of one afternoon in 1999?
And what this production team's done is go back and just comb through details, comb through evidence, and go and talk to people who were there and compare what they say to what they said at the time. And you get to hear police recordings, you get to hear recordings of the court, and what wasn't included in the court case. And what emerges is a very, mushy, actually, picture.
Exactly. So Sarah describes Adnan's memories as being very mushy, and she's very worried about that, because why can't he remember? They're so vague. Yet Jay's memories are detailed, but his memories have changed over the various times he had to recount them. So during his first, second and third police interviews. So it's sort of how to make sense of either incomplete memories on the one hand, or memories that are changing and seem inconsistent. And then you have all these people who are reflecting back now, 15 years later, on things that they might never have really paid much attention to at the time, knowing that Adnan was found guilty and is in jail, or believing something different. And how to then get back to the truth of the matter is incredibly problematic and incredibly interesting to listen to.
What are the characters that appears? I'm calling them characters. That's terrible, because they are real people. And this is a real crime with a real tragic loss of this young woman, Hay Min Lee, who just seems to have been quite fun as well as just, a lovely young woman. But one of the people who comes in is Aisha, and she has this extraordinary recall of the day, and she can say, "I talked to Adnan in the school library about this, and then we did this, and I walked out to the car and I borrowed this book, and then my boyfriend turned up and we had an argument about something and another friend." Her recall was extraordinary. Do you trust it?
I don't know how we could necessarily implicitly just go ahead and trust it, because at the time of the event, I think her name might be Nisha, actually. I'm not sure. Aisha might be one of Haman Lee's friends. And so Nisha, I think, wrote a letter or something like this to say, I had been in the library. But later on, when she was tracked down by investigators, she recanted that story and said, oh, no, I don't know. I don't remember. And now again, 15 years later, she's been tracked down again and says, oh, I do remember. So how to make sense of that kind of flip-flopping of memory? And we know from research that having detailed memories, it does not necessarily mean that the memories have to be true. People can have very detailed and confident memories and make a mistake.
But are there people who do have very precise recall? Are there certain personality types cognitive type of brains? Are there brains that work that way?
That's a really tricky question. I think it's hard to know because we weren't back there with them when they experienced. People can be extremely confident about their memories, and people also sort of claim expertise or they deny expertise. So you'll often talk to people who say, I'm terrible with names, or when we play Trivial Pursuit, I'll do the geography questions I'll do the sports questions. Now, there's a really interesting difference between what you say you're good at and what you actually are good at. And you do find that some people are especially good in certain areas. And we've been doing some research with long married older couples. Uh-huh. And we find that they have also, over decades of being together, sort of claimed areas of expertise in their memory. So the wife might remember the names and the birthdays of all the grandkids, and the husband remembers all of the various arrangements or financial details. So people do tend, in a way, to specialize.
outsource their memory storage to their partners.
Exactly. They're a system. There's a philosophical idea known as distributed cognition, which absolutely says that we're not just one person alone remembering. We remember in systems with our families, our partners, our friends, with our environment. And that's actually the way we need to get our complex lives done.
I have a friend, and I'm sure many people know somebody like this. I call her the social encyclopedia, because you can always go to her and say, whatever happened to, and she'll say, but don't you remember we went to that thing and that he was there and she said that and we all went home in so-and-so's car. And I go,
exactly.
I have nothing on this.
Yeah.
File is blank.
There's some wonderful research on what's called the kinkeeper, the person who, for instance, in a family is that kind of a person for us, who knows all the details and all the relationships and sort of keeps the memories of the family. And maybe they enjoy that, and that's the kind of role in the family. But it's tricky when we think, oh, that person's going to remember, but in fact that they don't, and our system sort of fails us. We've also been doing some neat work with siblings and twins, where we sometimes find that one sibling or twin will say, this is what happened to me, and they'll tell us a story of an event they experienced. The other one will say, that didn't happen to you, that happened to me.
Oh, wow.
Where they get mixed up about the source, who exactly experienced it, and becomes a sort of we memory, not an I memory, because it becomes sort of the province of the family, not any particular person.
Well, or you might be one of these people who believes a lot of the mystical stuff about twins. Maybe, you know, there is some kind of transfer.
Oh, absolutely. I have a PhD student, Amanda Selwood, who's a twin herself, and she's been testing just this idea about the special nature of twins. And what she's found in her research is that actually twins will often argue about their memories. And in other relationships, in some of our earlier work with long married couples, if they argue about their memories, that's really detrimental to how much they can recall. But twins can argue and it doesn't matter. It doesn't hurt them in a sense. It doesn't impair their remembering. So there might be something a little bit special about the process of their remembering, even if they don't necessarily remember more.
Well, this gets us back to serial, because in some way it seems that the memory actually is tied with the narrative. And what I mean by that is that as sense is made of what happened and a story is sort of pieced together, memory is then co-opted into that story. And is that the point where it becomes unreliable?
Well, reliability seems to me a slightly separate issue, but it's all, you're right, it's all about meaning making. And these people who are involved in this terrible crime, they've tried to make meaning over this event that happened. And we hear a lot about, you know, Sarah Koenig saying this particular person was so devastated or friendships broke up over it. But Sarah Koenig is also filtering all of these memories of these people through her meaning making. So we're hearing her take on it. She's presenting us certain things. But in everyday life, our memories are all about meaning making. Who are we? What are our relationships like? What are we like in the world? And so I think accuracy kind of stands a little bit outside of that. Memory researcher Martin Conway says that over time we strive for coherence in memories. That is a relationship between our sense of self and our memories rather than complete accuracy or correspondence.
Yeah, I know that this can be used in a therapeutic way in a narrative therapy, yeah. That people are invited to look back over traumatic experiences and just build the blocks, as it were, of things that happen and set them down and then build the next block on top. And so eventually you have a solid foundation and that story becomes less painful because it's understood.
Absolutely. And Donald Spence is a psychologist who talked about the difference between historical truth and narrative truth in therapy and said that what you're doing in therapy often is sort of, yeah, rebuilding those blocks into a narrative that you can live with and that is less painful and that doesn't need to necessarily match right onto historical truth.
Ah, right.
Of course, it's problematic when some of those memories leave that context, That's right. And I guess that's why the serial is so interesting, because memories that normally, our memories are great. They get us around day to day. They help us in our relationships. It's when we get into that courtroom where the standard of recall is so much stricter, and it needs to be. The consequences are very dire. It's harder for us to try and get back to all the accuracy, the complete details.
Tell us about the Oscar Pistorius case. You followed that with interest, particularly the way he was questioned about the way his story changed over the period from right after the death of Reeva Steenkamp to his final testimony.
Exactly. So he was interviewed after the event. He was interviewed during his plea bargaining. He was interviewed, I think, during the trial at different times. He was under cross-examination. And various details of his account changed. There was one discussion interaction where they talked about where a fan was plugged in on that night. Was it in this plug hole or that electrical outlet? And the prosecutor said, that shows, because you can't remember, it shows that you're lying. And he said, why should I remember where a fan was plugged in? It wasn't that important. So Oscar Pistorius was highlighting that that didn't matter, whereas the prosecutor was saying, if you don't remember that, if we can't trust you for those details, how can we trust you for anything? And that's where this tension between how memory is in everyday life and goes okay and what we need in the courtroom.
Do you know of any great tricks?
Any great tricks?
for being able to access memories accurately, or?
Yeah, walk through the perfume department in Maya, don't you think?
Of course.
So one thing we know is in order to remember things, you need to have the right kind of fishing hooks to get that memory out. You need the right kind of cues. And songs, all those 1980s songs that we love, perfume, smells, those kinds of sensory things are really, really useful
music.
For getting music. Yeah. I mean, it does it to us all the time, doesn't it?
You're suddenly straight back there. Now, Amanda, you're talking at a conference on almost exactly this topic by chance that you happen to be giving us a lecture or giving a public lecture on it. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so next week at Macquarie University, we have our annual Memory Day. So I'm part of a team, the Collective Cognition team, it's a whole interdisciplinary team of people all interested in memory. And next Wednesday night at the 2nd of December, we have Professor Harvey Whitehouse, who's from Oxford University. Now, Harvey's done this very amazing anthropological research. He was in Papua New Guinea, and he's really interested in explaining religion and religious organisations and the rituals and the way that they bring things together to kind of form an identity. And we're all about identity and memory as well. So he'll be speaking from 6 p.m. next Wednesday night at Macquarie University.
Oh, that's fantastically interesting. Cultural memory.
Exactly.
A whole other layer.
Exactly.
Thank you very much for coming and telling us about that, but also share your enthusiasm for serial. It's great to meet another serial tragic.
Thanks, Cassie.
That's Amanda Barnier. She's a professor of cognitive science at Macquarie University. And if you want to go to that talk, if you are in Sydney and you can get to Macquarie University, we'll put all the details on the Life Matters program page.